Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Johns Hopkins Hospital in March completed the most comprehensive penis and scrotum transplant in the world. The demand for such surgeries is increasing. The victims are often young soldiers returning from war. One study reported that nearly 1,400 men in the armed forces returned with injuries to their genitals and urinary organs between 2001 and 2013. The surgery at Johns Hopkins took 11 surgeons 14 hours to complete. Joining us now by phone is Los Angeles-based urologist and author of The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health, Dr. Dudley Danoff. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
11 surgeons, 14 hours, how does that rank in your book?
Well, right near the top. I mean, it sounds like the early days of kidney transplants. We thought it was a miracle to take a kidney from a cadaver and put it in a human being. It took about 14 surgeons in 14 hours. I mean, this is very complex surgery. It involves nerves. It involves vessels. It involves plumbing. It involves skin grafting. It involves implants. Very, very, very difficult surgery performed by a very, very heroic team and needed. I'm sure the next one will take less time and fewer surgeons, and, you know, 6 or 7 years from now, it might be quite routine for somebody to come in with a perineal or scrotal injury and have it repaired quite easily. So it is a major milestone.
Is the goal to repair the urinary organ? Is it to repair the sexual organ? I mean, what's the goal at this point?
I think the goal is to try to get
everything.
Everything, you know, but sometimes in surgery and particularly urology, we don't settle for everything. So, I mean, the continuity of the urinary streams so he can urinate to the tip of his penis would be ideal.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously to have a functional penis that can penetrate and perhaps even impregnate would be even a higher goal. So there's functionality. I think there's a certain cosmetic feature. A man is pretty much not a man if he doesn't have a scrotum or a penis. Big psychological factor there. So I think it's you've got to look at it from many, many angles.
This surgery did not involve the testicles. Is that another thing in the future?
Well, I think obviously the testicles are right in the line of fire. So we don't know how to do a testicular transplant as of yet, but we certainly could put a prosthetic device similar to an implant in a woman's breast, a testicular prosthesis, which we often use when we're removing a testicle for cancer, just to give continuity and a good cosmetic result.
As far as the cosmetics go, is that what's behind the goal of finding donors that are the same age?
Well,
is that a functionality issue?
Yeah, it's a functionality
issue.
You know, I've made the observation in my book, and when you think about it for a while, you know, if you take a look at the genitalia of an elderly man, I mean, take out the elderly man around the genitalia and that mm-hmm. of a younger man, it's very hard to tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost an ageless organ, especially when it's erect. So I think it's functionality more than anything, cosmetics more than anything.
Does this bode well for other urological problems that could be fixed with this kind of a transplant?
Well, I think it bodes well whenever we can make progress. I mean, in other words, if we have a problem today that we can't fix and next week we can fix it, that's progress.
Mm-hmm.
And all of medicine, and particularly urology over at least my practice lifetime, I mean, the advances where we started and where we are now with the use of robotics and lasers and microsurgery, it's incredible.
We are talking about the first penis and scrotum transplant done in March. It's a problem, particularly for returning vets. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Dr. Dudley Danoff, he's a urologist in Los Angeles and author of the book, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. In fact, we have Dr. Danoff on a relatively regular basis. If you have any questions about male sexual health, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, Dr. Danoff, when something like this happens, do you get calls from people saying, can I do this? Would this help me?
Well, I mean, not really. When you think about it, this is such a very unique injury.
It's still rare, yeah.
And it's a military injury. I don't think it's something we would see in private practice or even in a routine university setting. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of a rare bird that takes a tremendous effort, economic effort, a surgical effort, coordination of a huge team. So it's still a very, very rare bird.
Switching gears a little bit, let's talk about prostate testing. We've talked about it before. First of all, tell us about what it's screening for prostate cancer. How does it do it, and what's the goal?
What's the goal and what's the controversy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is controversy.
So, you know, just to kind of give you the parameters, 240,000 new cases this year, 30,000 men will die of it. The only way we can cure prostate cancer is to discover it at an early and treatable age. The only way to cure it, early diagnosis, is PSA and digital rectal exam. PSA is elevated or abnormal for many conditions other than prostate cancer, infection, sex, hard bowel movement, bicycle riding. Unfortunately, prostate cancer also elevates it. So it's very tricky. You have to discuss it with your urologists. You've got to make the diagnosis early. Many early diagnosed prostate cancers do not need to be treated. We put them in our watchful waiting active surveillance group. They don't go anywhere. But we've got to make the diagnosis, then make the differentiation between those that are aggressive and those that are kind of sleepy cancers. But all men over 40, African-American men particularly, between 40 and 70, need an annual prostate screening examination.
Why African-American men particularly?
Yeah, I think it's genetic. Nobody really knows the reason, but prostate cancer is more common in African-Americans.
Could it be environmental, though? Socioeconomic?
It might be environmental. It might be diet. African-Africans, for example, the same gene pool, do not have as high an incidence of prostate cancer as African-Americans. Mm-hmm. A lot of controversy about that, but it is just a fact.
So why so much debate over the PSA test? Is it the test or whether treatment ensues sooner rather than later that's debatable?
Well, the argument is that too many biopsies are being done and it's invasive and it might scare up somebody. You know, you can't have your head in the sand. I would like to know what I have, and then I want to speak with my urologist and I want to look at the options. Should I be aggressive? Should I not be aggressive? But I don't want any secrets lurking in my body that nobody knows about, and then at age 49 I wake up with metastatic prostate cancer. And we've certainly seen that in the absence of screening. So is it perfect? No. Is the world perfect? No. But we want information, and we want as much information as we can. And then let's sit down rationally, talk about the options, and then make intelligent choices.
In your line, what's the tipping point for you as a urologist as far as saying, yep, we need to start treatment? This is why?
Well, it's a complex question. You know, prostate cancer is multifaceted. There are sleepy prostate cancers. There are those that are very aggressive. So I would say it's the grade of the disease, how malignant is the tissue that we've removed, how aggressive is it, what's the stage, is it confined to the prostate, is it focal, is it multifocal? So there are many, many factors that we look at before we, you know, boom ahead and do a surgical procedure. And then, even if we need to do a surgical procedure, which we would consider aggressive, we do it with a robot. Hmm. No incision, an overnight stay in the hospital, potency sparing, continence sparing. A month or two after the operation, the patients say, "Doc, did I have an operation?"
Mm-hmm. But there is controversy. I mean, there is the surgery does cause or can cause,
yes,
incontinence and impotency.
Yes. So it's surgeon dependent. So the more experienced the surgeon, the less that is apt to happen. And you always have to look at the risk-benefit ratio. So there's a very, very small risk of incontinence today in our hands. There's a very, very small risk of impotence in our hands. But the benefit is great. 40% fewer deaths since the introduction of PSA and early diagnosis.
And when was that, when it was introduced?
In the 1990s. So we're looking about, you know, almost 30 years of experience now in what we call the PSA era, early diagnosis. I mean, in the 1990s or in the 80s, I would make the diagnosis with a digital rectal exam and feel a hard mass, and 80% of those people were inoperable at the time I first diagnosed it.
How does the screen go? How does it work?
It's a blood test, a very, very simple blood test, and a digital rectal exam is a gloved examining finger. We feel the prostate through the rectum. It feels like a little walnut. It should be small. It should be soft. It should be symmetrical. It should be non-tender. No lumps or bumps or irregularity. It's very analogous to a breast exam.
Uh-huh. And if the blood test shows an elevated PSA level, what does that mean?
Well, it can mean a lot of things, but unfortunately, it can mean prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. So infection, bowel movement, sexual activity, some people who have just intrinsically high PSA, just benign prostatic enlargement as the prostate gets larger, even if it's benign, it produces PSA. So it is a nuanced test, but there's a difference between accepting a nuanced test and ignoring a test which is very effective.
Do lots of men ignore this test, or is it the doctors that are ignoring it?
Well, lots of doctors ignore it. HMOs hate it because they don't want to treat anything, so they don't want to find out you're sick.
But on the other hand, wouldn't they rather find out early than later?
Well, in my experience, they're the most reluctant to recommend it. And all urologists, I mean, every urologist that's in the pit dealing with prostate cancer on a daily basis knows that this is a great test. But there's a lot of people out there that, you know, become very rich by not doing that test.
Is it covered by the Affordable Care Act?
It is.
Okay. And when it shows an elevated PSA level, then you look at what's next. Then you do the digital rectal exam.
First, we try to rule out, is there anything else that could have elevated the PSA? And if there is, we treat it, infection, et cetera. We'll repeat it to make sure it's not a laboratory error. Then we do a biopsy, which takes about 2 minutes, done under local anesthesia in the office. It's extremely safe. We cover the patients with antibiotics, and then we make the diagnosis, and then we look at the tissue. Is it aggressive tissue? And then we stage it. We do an MRI, a CT. Is it in the prostate? Is it outside the prostate? Is it in the bones? And then we make a decision. We put all of that in this giant cauldron, stir it around, and come up with an answer.
With prostate cancer, it's you said it's robotic?
The surgical procedure that we do today to remove the prostate is done with a robot.
Okay.
Three or four little keyhole incisions. It's 15 times magnified. There's essentially no blood loss. You can see the nerves perfectly. You can anastomose the vessels perfectly, put the plumbing back together perfectly. It's the most remarkable advance I've seen in my over 30 years of practicing urology.
What do we need a prostate, or what do men need a prostate for?
It carries the fluid that carries the sperm. So the prostate fluid itself is not sperm. It's a lubricating fluid.
Uh-huh.
The testicles produce the sperm. A man ejaculates the fluid that carries the swimmers to their destination is prostate fluid. And as men get older, the gland becomes less efficient. And by becoming less efficient, it compensates by becoming larger and just getting in the way.
Okay.
So it's like a donut getting bigger and the hole in the donut getting smaller.
Okay.
Causes freaking urination, getting up at night, incomplete bladder emptying.
Those are all familiar symptoms we hear about.
Yes.
And do you remove prostates when they get enlarged, just in general, or is it only if they're cancerous?
Well, we don't remove the whole prostate if it's benign. We just remove or deal with the obstructed part of the prostate if it's not malignant.
Okay. Dr. Dudley Danoff, as always, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. We'll do it again.
All right. Dr. Dudley Danoff, urologist in Los Angeles and author of the book, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. We'll continue Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. More Americans are overweight than ever. 7 out of 10 Americans currently rank as overweight. 4 out of 10 are obese. A big factor is overeating, and that often is a function of stress eating. Associate Clinical Professor of Family and Community Medicine and Pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, Laurel Mellon developed a neuroscience-based approach to stem stress eating. She recently wrote about the strategy for the conversation. We'll post a link to her article at WOSU.org/allsides, and also we'll post a link to EBT.org as well. Laurel Mellon joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Anne. I'm happy to be here.
Overeating. So what? How is that defined?
Well, when you're eating in any way that detracts from your health and happiness, it's overeating. But in particular, after 30 years of studying obesity, we know it's really not inactivity that's causing the problem. It's bouts of overeating. And up until now, people thought that the food or the behavior was the problem. And it's now clear that even though we all know what we should eat, we can't do it. And it's because we haven't included neuroscience. And neuroscience makes this so much easier because we're going to the root cause, the wires that trigger stress eating.
Stress eating. Okay, so let's define stress eating. Is that binge eating popcorn while I'm watching a scary show or what?
That's the popular definition. You know, people sometimes know that they stress eat because they say, oh, I just had a really bad day at work, or I just had a fight with my partner, and so I know that I'm eating to stuff down my feelings. That's probably the minority of stress eaters. If you look at it from a brain standpoint, this is how it looks. We all have fight-or-flight drives that are encoded in our circuits, particularly for anything that's survival-based, and food is. If those circuits in our brain are encoded from experiences where we were stress overloaded and we eat, it creates a link between stress and overeating. And then from then on, that circuit in our brain, unless we rewire it, and we know we can rewire it now, It even with small stresses, little upsets, it will get triggered. But here's the part that's most difficult, Anne, that when we have a stress activation, a circuit that makes us overeat, it can be perceived. We can perceive that we're hyper aroused, we're upset, we're depressed, we're anxious, we're out of control, and that's one presentation. But there are two other symptoms when we're stress eating, when that circuit's been activated. And one is we go absolutely numb, and we really sort of lose consciousness, and we just mindlessly eat, or we go onto a false high, and we really think that we just enjoy food. So it's a small percentage of people who think they stress eat, when essentially almost everyone who eats when they're not hungry and says to themselves, I'm not going to do that again. Why am I overeating? Mm-hmm. Has a stress circuit in their brain, and until we rewire it, they will keep on overeating.
So when I keep going back to the break room because somebody brought in a bunch of cookies and I just
keep,
I keep telling myself, well, at least I have to get up and walk to get there.
Yeah.
Is that stress eating? And yes, I can't understand why I'm not hungry. Why am I doing
right.
this?
Exactly. And, you know, with these, the circuits in our brain are very protective. The homeostatic circuits, they create balance and connection. And essentially, they, when they're not one of these survival or stress circuits, you know, you kind of look at the food, you connect with yourself, you say, I think I want to be vibrant and healthy. I don't think I need that extra food. And those circuits that are healthy, we call them homeostatic circuits in neurophysiology, they keep you really on the up and up because you're getting chemicals of reward just by connecting with yourself. Once that's disrupted and a survival circuit, a stress circuit is encoded, it rips apart that connection to the deepest part of you. It stops the flow of those sustainable chemicals. So you don't feel rewarded. You really do need the extra food. So with emotional brain training, what we do is we essentially you identify there's typically four circuits everybody has. They're very common. Almost everybody has them. Four wires that either tell you to eat or tell you to do stressful things that turn on your drive to overeat. Huh. And you rewire each one so that you not only don't want to go in that direction of the overeating or the unbalanced mood, but you go to someplace connected with well-being so you get the chemicals without the calories.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about overeating and the relationship with how the brain is wired. My guest is Laurel Mellon. She's a associate clinical professor of family and community medicine and pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine and founder of Emotional Brain Training. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Mellon, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to talk about emotional brain training, but I also wanted to get to the issue that you wrote that traditional weight loss programs are partly to blame because they don't address the stress reactions that trigger overeating. And that really reminded me of when I quit smoking 30 years ago, I did a behavior modification, smoke stoppers, and they talked a lot about the stress reactions and the triggers for cigarette and nicotine addiction.
Right. So the triggers that they used to think about as, well, you triggered to overeat, that's no longer current neuroscience. It's now what's the circuit. In other words, if you have a circuit in your brain that attaches you, let's say, to smoking, what happens is the same thing as food. You have a survival drive that essentially takes the prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, your consciousness, and derails it and lets the reptilian brain take over and reflexively repeat the same pattern. These are the survival circuits I'm talking about. The reason that you're talking about two different things here. One of them is symptom substitution. If you stop the behavior without rewiring the survival circuit, that survival circuit goes on to another excess. So you go from smoking to drinking to overworking to whatever, mm-hmm. and you're not any better. You just trade symptoms. The other part of that is the reason why I followed obesity and been a researcher in obesity for 30 years. I'm just devastated at what is happening right now mm-hmm. because essentially people are being told, and again, this neuroscience is not, it's rooted in the most fundamental science we have, and yet somehow because it's weight, I don't know whether it's because people have weight problems or weight issues are trivialized or there's discrimination or all of the above, but they keep telling us that it's the food when it's actually the circuit. If they rewire the circuit, they stop wanting the food. And because the circuit's gone, they're less likely to have anything else. But the dieting, when you're dieting and you're dieting against a survival drive to overeat, it creates more stress, it strengthens the survival circuit, and it makes you feel more powerless and more self-blaming. So dieting makes it worse. The idea is go to the root cause, rewire that circuit. It only takes a month. It's not hard to do. You use emotional tools. And what happens is the drive to overeat turns off.
Well, how does it work? Well, how do you rewire your brain in a month?
Well, you have to do it 30 minutes a day, so it's not completely easy. But you start the first 10 days of the 30-day challenge, and you come in and you learn how to process emotions. The big deal is we have been a country that thinks too much and acts too much. We really believe that solving problems is about thinking and doing. These circuits, these emotional circuits that control 80% of health problems are in the emotional brain, and they only are rewired with emotional tools. So you learn emotional techniques so that you can get to a state of connection and you understand how to use your emotions effectively. Once you do that, you spend the next 12 days, 3 days each, identifying a personal circuit that's causing your overeating. There's one for food, like I get a message in the brain that's survival drive that essentially creates the stress. I get my safety from eating sugar. And that seems like it should be it. But in the brain, when you're stressed, you co-activate a lot of other stress circuits that just amplify the drive to overeat. So first people target a food circuit, and they discover what that hidden message is, and then create a new message that's called a power grind-in. So every time they want to overeat, they can use that power grind-in, and it will shut down the circuit. Each time it shuts down the circuit gets weaker, and pretty soon they notice they don't want to overeat. Interestingly, that's not enough. They also need to address three other circuits. We all have a mood circuit. When we're overeating, we're typically in an unbalanced mood. We want to rewire that one. Also, relationships, although they're wonderful, they create a lot of stress. And in stress, people either distance or merge with other people. Rewire that. And then lastly, with weight comes a negative body image. And people either hold on to extra weight in order to feel safe. Maybe there's been abuse. Or they develop a negative attitude toward their body and really disparage their body. That creates drives to overeat, too. So they come in for 30 days, and in the middle part, they rewire those four circuits and get that power grind in. It's personalized to their circuits. So anytime the reptile starts to ramp up and make them in a bad mood or overeat, they state these personalized words that are very emotional to themselves, and it short circuits the drive. And the whole idea is at the end of the program, they adopt a healthier, more vibrant lifestyle, and they notice that they don't have that drive to overeat, and they can continue with the work and find that they have more freedom and can lose weight more easily. That's the whole point. And one more thing,
mm-hmm.
30 days is when they get their tools and they see amazing reset in their brain. But the real change comes after that, which is they can stay with EBT and move up the emotional set point of their brain. And when their emotional set point is higher, so they're not stuck in stress, mm-hmm. those circuits that cause overeating do not get reinstated. So that's the idea of 30 days to really reset your brain and then stay with it to raise your emotional set point.
What are stress? I mean, sometimes it's hard for people to identify what stress is. They don't all feel it the same way, but you're saying there's really everybody does have these four main wires.
Everyone does.
Yeah.
The only difference is we also have a stress program for emotional issues and behavioral health. And essentially, the three of the four circuits are the same. Everyone has a behavioral circuit. Everyone has a mood circuit. Everyone has a relational circuit, because that's how the brain behaves when we're in chronic stress. And most of us are in chronic stress. It used to be the set point. There's a five-point system for stress. One is state of neural integration. Everything, you know, you really are impervious. You're just at your best all the time and you feel so much joy, all the way down to a set point of five where the reptilian brain is in charge. What I've seen over the last 30 years is the set point collectively of our country is going down, largely because of the stress overload that everyone's experiencing. The brain is not happy with such information overload and such impossible expectations and so many unnatural, artificial ways of coping, like technology. So the set point's going down. The more the set point of the country goes down, the more we're all going to have emotional, relational, and behavioral problems because that's how the brain is. And if we cover them up with medications, procedures, and devices, and don't empower people to use simple emotional tools to rewire those circuits and move up their set point, the whole healthcare system is just simply not going to be sustainable. Emotional brain training is a new paradigm of healthcare. There's been articles mm-hmm. written as saying, why don't we go to the root cause, which is stress in the brain, give people the power to clear it out.
In situations where obesity runs in a family, is it possible that there is a genetic piece here, that one of these wires is genetically weaker in certain families and in certain people?
There are genetic contributors to weight, but they're relatively small and they're isolated. There's a belief there's about 2% of people who are actually genetically obese. And then the rest tends to be epigenetic and the combination of a genetic component, if it is there, and environment. What we've seen in the last 30 years of this incredible epidemic of obesity is environmental. And the good part is that we know now that we've been treating the wrong brain. We've been telling people to use their thinking brain, to use willpower, when the whole drive to overeat is in the emotional brain. So the positive emotional plasticity movement that's now on to give people these tools is going to help us. I think it's going to turn it around, because now people are so discouraged about dieting, people just say, I'm not going to do it anymore. it doesn't work. It just makes me worse.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a growing opportunity for neuroscience-based weight loss and essentially people taking their power back instead of being overly reliant on medications and surgery for something that if they changed the circuitry in their brain, essentially with emotional tools, they wouldn't have to do. So I think we're coming to a new age of neuroscience-based weight loss and healthcare.
You know, I've talked with experts in the field of eating disorders, including bulimia, anorexia, that kind of a thing. And that's been a huge issue for them as well, understanding yes. better the neural component of all this.
Exactly. Well, you know, these survival circuits aren't finicky. We all have them. And anytime we're in a state of stress overload, these circuits get encoded and activated. And whatever that we do in that moment, whether it's binge eating or purging or smoking or drinking, the brain then just makes that survival circuit, that association, that false association between survival and the drinking, eating, purging, whatever. And then it hides it in the brain. It over-remembers it. It holds on to it. It hides it in the brain. It doesn't want us to get it, and it won't let us rewire it unless we have emotional tools and we're at the same level of stress we were in when it was encoded. And then it just opens up and we can begin to rewire it. So all of these problems you're speaking about are all based on neurophysiology of these survival circuits, and they are plastic. In 2010, research at NYU, not UCSF, actually proved that humans could rewire these. And if we don't use emotional tools and we just try to think our way out of it, be mindfully aware out of it, the circuits seem to go away. But then once we're back in stress again, woof, they come up, they're big time, and then we think, what? I must be powerless. There must be something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
We blame ourselves, we're more stressed, and we activate the circuits again. So
it really, you know, but a lot of us are still brought up with the idea that, you know, you only get one set of brain cells, and once you mess them up, they're messed up for life. Do you find there's a cultural resistance to this kind of a thing?
Not so much.
What
we find is that people understand that, well, people understand that everyone has trauma. And I believe that. And I believe that the only people that don't have trauma are very unfortunate. Because if you have no trauma, you're never going to be able to have the full range of empathy that you have when you've been to hell and back with life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've had hard times, sooner or later, you always have these survival circuits. And even people with moderate stress have these survival circuits. And when you re-encode them, what happens is you become more loving. You become more connected. You become more resilient. And you look over at your friend across the street who seems to have a perfect life. And they're kind of in a mediocre mood, but you're in joy and you're resilient and you're compassionate at a new level. So essentially, if it doesn't kill you or if it doesn't stress you out, it's probably not good for you, because if you are stressed out, you've had a lot, when you rewire those circuits, you end up being more loving, more altruistic, and happier than people who have not had those hard times.
Laura O'Mellon, I'll once again say it's EBT, E as in elephant, B as in boy, T as in, I don't know what.
Tom.
EBT training, EBT.org. EBT.org
yes.
Is the website. Laura O'Mellon, thanks a lot for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Such a pleasure, Ann. Thank you so much.
Laura O'Mellon is an associate clinical professor of family and community medicine and pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, and founder of Emotional Brain Training. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. That's a rendition of Billy Joel's For the Longest Time by the Ultrasounds. It's an a cappella group made up of OSU medical students. They're part of the OSU Medicine and the Arts Program. The program was founded in 2009 by Dr. Linda Stone to provide an escape for OSU medical students, faculty, and staff. The program is hosting a gala next week that includes the talent of multi-Grammy nominee, recording artist, and Broadway actress Maureen McGovern. She joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Good morning.
Wow, it's a thrill to have you here. And Maureen McGovern just sang on my show. And also joining us, retired family physician and founder of Humanism in Medicine and Medicine and the Arts at OSU, Dr. Linda Stone. Welcome back.
Well, thanks for having us.
So this has endured.
It has. It has. And part of it is the wonderful people that walk through the door to help us.
Like
Maureen
McGovern. Yeah.
We are thrilled to have her. She brings such a beautiful perspective because of her whole life in the arts, but also because she's touched the lives of so many people through her work with music therapy and the MD Association.
Yeah, tell us about your work with music therapy.
I have always believed since I was young that music reaches inside of us and changes things. You know, I mean, I've had a passion for music.
That's why we sing in the shower,
right?
Kind of thing, yeah.
And we sound so good,
yes.
Don't we, in the shower?
Yes.
But the morning after, 45 years ago, I recorded that song, and I still get letters from people today how that song has helped them through a death in the family, a divorce, you know, some trauma. And I remember at some point in my career early on thinking, there's a message in this. There's something. That's why I was put here, mm-hmm. to sing things that inspire, that unite us, that do comfort us. And so the American Music Therapy Association sort of put it all together to me as what music physically and spiritually and everything does. You know, I can see the work that they do.
I'd love to see brain scans on people when they're not just when
right.
they're hearing music, but when they're singing or when they're making music.
Yeah, it allows us to step outside of ourselves. It's you know, we're all, like I said, water and vibrations, and it gets in and cleanses things, you know, inside.
Yeah.
It's just it always has been to me a very, very healing situation. So I worked with Muscular Dystrophy Association for about 35 years. I was on the board there for a while and vice president. And, you know, saw again how the power of music with all the children that we met, how it changes their lives in the physical, spiritual, and emotional way. And the families, it's always comforting for them. So,
when you sing, does it make you feel better still?
Yeah. I sing all day long,
okay.
Whether I'm on stage. I mean, I'm going around the house, you know.
You do?
Singing, yeah. Post whatever, and I'm thinking, why did that pop into my head? But it's just a lifting up of the spirit, you know. I have sung in hospices, in prisons right here.
That's right, at Marysville.
Marysville, yeah.
Yeah, correction.
And it was one of the most profound, wonderful events I ever
had. Well, I know
we laughed,
it had a
we
big
cried.
Effect on the people, on the inmates at the prison, Yeah.
Yeah. Patty Lynn Brown. She's just.
Pat Lynn Brown, yeah.
She's, yeah. Wynn Brown. There we mm-hmm. go. But I was talking with Dr.
Right.
I know this one as well as I know my name.
Yeah, Dr.
I'm
Stone.
A senior. I am 68 and 9 points. Yes. So
Spring
I'm.
Chicken. So.
Yeah. Anyway. There was a young woman sitting two rows in front of me, and when I started to sing the morning after, she was looking down, and she looked up, and her just tears flew from her eyes. She was young, and I'm thinking, why is this song hitting her in such a way?
She didn't see the Poseidon Adventure.
Yeah,
right, yeah.
And afterwards, she came up, I gave her a big hug, and she said, you know, her mother had died at like 58, so did my mother at the same time, same age.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she used to sing it to me as a lullaby. You know, so
wow.
Yeah, I mean, there's just a wonderful power of music.
You know, Dr. Stone, we've talked to you before about this, but why did it occur to you that medicine and the arts, and not necessarily about the patients, but about the doctors and the staff and the people who are involved in providing medical services, why did that occur to you?
I had the privilege of serving the College of Medicine through student affairs. And so in that job, you're talking a lot every day to students, and you realize there's a lot going on as far as stress is concerned, burnout. We know that depression and suicide rates are higher in the medical profession. So in that job, you're mostly trying to help people move through difficult times. So the idea with the beginning Medicine and the Arts Board was, how do we go further upstream and begin to really do some interventions that are going to help us create a more humanistic environment for those who care for our patients and teach and do research? How do we get to that group of people and help them move through into life more resilient?
You know, is it though been an ilk of people that maybe at first is a little resistant to that? They've been studying for so many years. They've been, you know, they're so smart, book smart kind of thing.
It was the remarriage of the art and science of medicine. So you're absolutely right. There are some doubters among us. But once they come to a concert or hear ultrasound sing or look at what the writers group has written or the dance troupe, they begin to understand. We had a really interesting internal medicine grand rounds a few weeks ago on humanism. And a very astute physician said, you know, I was wondering about all this humanism stuff. And he said, but today we presented the whole student section, he said, today was an aha moment. I understand it's about, you know, us, about caring for ourselves so we can care for others. And I think that was the whole idea. But I'll tell you, Ann, with the Humanism Medicine Initiative, Medicine and the Arts, the right people have walked through the door at the exact right time.
What, people like Maureen McGovern?
Yes. Oh, she's got to share. I'm going to share a little story
about it.
We visited Nationwide Children's Hospital a year and a half or two years ago, and we went to visit a patient with muscular dystrophy. And watching at the bedside, Maureen asked the young patient if she could sing to him, and she did, and his face was just transformed. And then he sang to her, which was a beautiful moment.
What did he sing?
He had his own composition.
He had his own composition, I think, that he sang, yeah. It was
beautiful.
You know, it was just beautiful.
I remember when I was a real little girl, you'd just make up songs.
Sure.
And you're sitting on the swing.
Yeah.
And then we kind of get that beat out of us or worked out of us or, you know, I don't mean that literally, but kind of the world.
Well, the arts are kind of treated like, you know.
An aside.
That aside. Yeah. That fun stuff.
A luxury for some.
Yeah.
But when I read about the rates of suicide among physicians, twice the general population,
right.
4 out of 10 or 6 out of 10 suffer from depression, that's really, and feel like they have to sublimate it a lot. They don't want your patient to know you're bummed out that day, right? So you have to sublimate it.
You're absolutely, the bottom line is, how do we better care for the patients we love and serve?
Yeah.
And one thing we have to remember, part of that is loving and serving ourselves, taking care of ourselves so we're there for the people that we serve. And patients know. I remember times in the office when I would go in and patients said, are you all right? Instead of my saying, before I even got in the door. And then you'd say, oh, I've got a bad cold today, but I'm wearing a mask, so you'll be okay. But I think patients sense, and of course they wonder if it's them, and it isn't. So I think we share back and forth. It's a relationship. The patient and the physician have this very sacred relationship, and we have to share those things, and patients want to know we're taking care of ourselves, and then we better take care of them.
Yeah.
Dephoria Lane is a music therapist in Cleveland. I call her the Mother Teresa of Cleveland because I've gone on rounds with her in numerous hospitals and hospices, and all the molecules in the room change when she comes in, and she'll get patients that look like they're on their deathbed and, you know, come to life and sing. And we sang with one at a hospice, a woman who was very, very near death, and the family was, of course, very sad. And so we came in, and she asked the family what kind of music does your mother like? And so they said, well, she liked country. So she had an auto harp. She started playing Almost Heaven, West Virginia. So I started singing harmony with her. And all of a sudden, the woman started breathing harder, and I thought, oh, we're making this worse, you know. But she was breathing really hard. And then, I mean, her eyes were fixed and everything. She was clearly very close to death. And we heard, hoo, hoo, hoo. And everybody in the room went, what was that? And so we continued to sing. We got to that same spot in the song. Because the hearing is the last to go.
Right.
And it, you know, it meant something to her, obviously. Yeah. But what it meant to the family was just, you know, we're all, you know, weeping and just amazing. But, I mean, to see her in motion, she's a DeForia Lane is just, you know. Dr. Linda Stone is one of my heroes.
Yeah.
DeForia Lane is one of my heroes. So.
Carrie in Columbus, you're on the air.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
I want to make a comment. My brother had passed away, and he had donated his body to OSU Medical. And then last year, last September or August, they had a memorial service for all of the people that had donated their.
That's right.
And there was a young man, and unfortunately, I can't find my program from there. And he played the violin, and he played, I forget what it's called, Something Sunrise from the Ken Burns Civil War.
Huh. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my word, Anne. That was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
It was just so wonderful, and it just made you feel, it just comforts you. And it was just, I mean, they had, they were all wonderful because they had music groups and things, and the cellos and the things. But this young man's version on this
it affected
the violin, oh my God.
Right.
It was,
yeah.
You couldn't have asked for anything better.
Yeah, you know, Carrie, thanks a lot. Yeah, I think probably Mark O'Connor played the music for the Civil War, incredibly virtuoso violinist for the Ken Burns Civil War series, which was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing how music reminds us of something and triggers something. Nikki in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Hey, I just wanted to call in and comment on your topic. And actually executive director of a local nonprofit that supports and enhances music and art therapy and that serves ill children and their families. So I can really relate to the patient experience, but also I'm sure it's super helpful for the caregivers as a parent, but also as doctors and nurses too. So we experienced music therapy when we were when our daughter was treated at Nationwide and at Cincinnati Children's, and it just meant so much to us. So it's become, you know, how I sort of decided to give back after she passed away a few years. So
thank you. Thank you, Nikki.
Yeah.
Thanks. Thanks for that call. And then there's the thing about performing together, right, Linda Stone? Like with the a cappella group, the Ultrasounds. Doing it together, there's something going on there too, right?
You're absolutely right. They form small families, like the professional school orchestra or ultrasound, the writers group, the dance troupe. Each one of them creates a little family.
Yeah.
And when you go in and watch the rehearsals or the concerts, you see the transformation on their face from a very stressed student walking into rehearsal, picking up their instrument or getting ready to rehearse or dance. And you can tell this is what we call the healing presence of the arts.
Yeah. Wow.
It's beautiful.
Well, Dr. Linda Stone, thank you so much for joining us again. And, you know, congratulations on the success of your program.
Thank you.
Dr. Linda Stone is a retired family physician, founder of Humanism in Medicine and Medicine and the Arts at Ohio State University. And, of course, Maureen McGovern, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. And I'm thrilled to be with Medicine and the Arts.
Maureen McGovern, a multi-Grammy nominee, Broadway and recording artist, performing at Humanism in Medicine and Medicine and the Arts Honors Reception coming up next week. It's by invitation only, but we thought we'd tell you about it. You can go learn more at wosu.org/allsides for more information. Thanks for listening today. This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.